Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 17th, 2002. Today's session is titled Gates to the Holy City, People and Land, Session 3, Herod's Gate, presented by Susan and Michael Thomas. Let's listen in.
Today, we'd like to sing a phrase from an Israeli folk song that also speaks about a vision of peace, and this is an Old Testament text. Actually, appears in a couple of places. But the tune is this: and everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. Will you join me in that, please? And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. It's a vision, obviously, of what we would hope could be the case in the Holy Land, and that those who are finding it too difficult and fearful to live might find a place where they can indeed have a quiet and peaceable life together, and where your rights are respected. Shall we try to begin with these? Once again, we're having a little bit of a technical problem.
Chris, can you take the lens cap, please, off the projector? And I'm sorry, can you focus it as well? Thank you. Thank you. Once again, the theme is peace and justice in the Middle East. This was done, how many have been in previous sessions? Okay, so most of you. So this was done by children of the congregation on our retreat where we were talking about this. And once again, we situate ourselves in the long history of the Middle East with the Madaba map that goes back to the 6th century and from the city of Jordan, a mosaic map. This is a map of the holy city, Jerusalem, translated from the Greek. And it's a part of a much larger mosaic of the entire known world. It is worth a trip to Jordan just to see this wonderful mosaic about the size of this room. We're going to be talking about Herod's Gate. Why it's called Herod's Gate is not done. Let me make sure we're in the right.
You might not have the right set of slides.
We'll see. No, we don't. So we'll just go back. But the first couple of slides are the same, so.
Shall I run to get the other one?
So the first three slides are the same and the batteries are getting a little weak here.
Michael, maybe you should do it from the back.
So what we're doing today, we're going to come, the slides, because of the software we're using, puts things in a different order. But we're going from Herod's Gate. The Arabic name for this gate is the gate that watches. The gate that watches. And that image can be used in a variety of ways. God that watches over all of us, those that watch over, trying to maintain their security, their control on everything that happens below them, hence the image of Herod and security, that connection, and also those who watch over people who have no one else to watch over them, who need someone to cry justice and fairness in certain cases. And so we go from Herod's Gate, we go about 30 miles south to the city of Hebron, an entirely Muslim city, a city that has roots in the Old Testament. It's where Abraham purchased a cave to bury his relatives in. And that cave also became holy to the Muslims as well. And so until 1992, there was a synagogue and mosque that were adjoining. And then in that year, an American-born Jew became Israeli, Bernard Goldstein. Baruch Goldstein came in with a rifle and killed about 29 Muslim worshipers. And immediately, and he was killed in turn by the Muslims that were not killed. Welcome. He was killed, and immediately the Israeli army clamped down on the Palestinians, and there was a curfew. And so the upshot is that the Palestinians were punished for the murder by a Jewish man of Palestinian Muslims. And the tension in the city goes back a long ways. It goes back to at least 1929, when there was the so-called incident of the Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall in Jerusalem, which most Jews venerate as a shrine, as a place of holiness. And there had been conflict in in that part of the old city, and that conflict spread to Hebron, where a number of Jews, many Jews, were killed or driven out by the Muslim Palestinians living there at the time. Though it's important to note that some of the Muslims harbored and gave sanctuary to the Jewish inhabitants of of Hebron in 1929. And that massacre of 1929 has not been forgotten. After 1948, Hebron belonged to Jordan. Then, following the 1967 war, Israel captured Hebron, and it came under their control. Shortly following that, a Jewish group came down to make pilgrimage to the cave of Abraham, to the synagogue, and they stayed in a hotel, and they stayed, and they stayed, and they stayed, and eventually it was clear that they were settling in. They were there for the long term, and that action, that sort of creation of a fact on the ground, forced the Israeli government to offer protection for this group. That was the first settlement in Hebron by Jews since 1929. And then around Hebron, various Jewish settlements were also created. So more and more Israeli troops were needed to make sure that the security needs of the settlers, the Jewish settlers, would be maintained. And now in Hebron, which is an ancient city, it's not quite as ancient as Barbara said, but it certainly is an ancient city. It's not as ancient as Jericho, for instance. It's a compact city, and in the most concentrated part of the city, where in a sense the energy is concentrated around the cave, the synagogue and the mosque, the burial site. Around that area, which is entirely Palestinian except for a small group of Jewish settlers numbering about 400 and about 1,400 Israeli troops protect them. That area is known as H1, and following the Oslo Accords, the rest of the city of Hebron reverted to Palestinian control and security. But H1, this intense energy site around the cave was under Israeli security. And it has, as I mentioned, about 400 settlers, and there are about 18,000 Muslims that live in that area that's controlled by the Israeli military. And there is always tension, or often tension, between the settlers and the and the Palestinians, and sometimes between the settlers and the military that is there to protect them. It's no secret that many of the military do not like these settlers at all. They walk around, they stride around as if they own the land, and that's their position, in fact, that they own this. This was bought by them. They own it. And so we're going to take a quick trip to Hebron on two different occasions.
For those of you who came in late, we are dealing with the fact that we had these slides in order, and now but the software will not be showing them in the order we anticipated.
Well, this is working now.
It's working.
This is right here.
Good.
This is in November 2001. Intifada has broken out 2 months earlier. There is tension in many parts of the West Bank, but in Hebron it's pretty much the same because the Israeli troops are still there. And the only, Hebron is under curfew at this point, and the only people that are allowed to walk outside, this is all Palestinian, the only people that are allowed to walk outside are internationals and Jewish settlers, such as this man right here. Yeah. No Palestinians are allowed to walk outside. We're here.
So Palestinians, are they in their homes?
They're in their homes, yeah. What would you do if you were in your home for say 3 weeks without an opportunity to go outside? That sometimes the curfews have been that long. Usually, most often, the curfew is lifted every couple of days for a few hours.
So how would you educate your children?
And so we are visiting right now a group called the Christian Peacemaker Team. Rich Meyer, a farmer from Indiana, his wife is a Mennonite minister in Indiana, is leading us. Rich has come for a three-month tour of duty. We'll talk a little bit after the slideshow about the Christian Peacemaker Team. We're also with the South African representative to the Palestinian Authority, this woman here, and we're taking a walk around the city to see what's happening.
And this is Hebron proper. It's not necessarily H1.
It is. This is in this concentrated square kilometer where there are 18,000 Palestinians today.
Hebron proper is Hebron. H1 and H2 are all Hebron.
Okay. There are about 130,000 Muslim in Hebron.
I have a question.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned every time new settlers came in required more soldiers. How was it decided the settlers would go? Was that their own private decision? Was there some kind of governmental cooperation? Was it a strategy?
Well, initially when the settlers came to the hotel, I think it was in '68, and stayed. That was at their own initiative, but. The settlements around Hebron are part of an Israeli land settlement strategy to essentially encircle Palestinian land. You have to understand, this is Judea. This is biblical Judea, and for religious Jews, this is an important part of their history. They feel a 3,000-year link with Hebron, and for them, it feels like coming home. Now, the way that they come home, so to speak, is a rather arrogant way. They believe the Muslims have absolutely no claim to this land and that they should be gone. And so for the first time since we've come, transfer policy is actually talked about inside the civil society of Israel, within the government, transferring Palestinians to other lands, albeit voluntarily.
And it's also important to understand that this is one segment of Israeli society and the most fanatic.
By far the most fanatic.
What percentage of the Israeli population, the Jewish Israeli population, would you say is supporting this type of policy?
A small, I think a rather small percentage. I think the majority is.
But they're current administration.
It depends. I mean, a lot has changed in the last year. But I from what I've read in the Israeli press, most Israelis would be willing, if they knew that they could have peace, they would be willing to evacuate the entire West Bank, including the settlements. But the population of the settlements has gone up from, in 1991 it was about 100,000, now it's 200,000, even though the Oslo Agreement specified that there would be no more settlement building. And so 100,000 more Israeli settlers have moved in.
So is it the administration's policy, the Israeli administration's policy now to support this?
Well, Ariel Sharon was one of the architects of the settlement idea and has been a strong supporter of it all along. And Benjamin Netanyahu, his predecessor, was not his immediate predecessor, but his predecessor in the party that he's part of, also is generally a strong supporter of the settlement policies.
Are the settlers, are they more recent immigrants, or who tends to be settlers?
Right around from New York City.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in Hebron, yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, the language is well, it's both.
Is that true of all these settlements?
No. There are lots. See, there's some settlements that are, by international law, are clearly settlements on occupied land and are illegal according to international law, but they feel like suburbs.
Uh-huh.
They would feel like a suburb to most of us. So they're right on the periphery of the metropolitan area of Jerusalem, and most people, I would assume most Israelis who live on those settlements in the periphery have no idea that they're living on occupied land, or it's pushed way out of their mind. They're living in a suburb. They're living in a neighborhood. Gilo, opposite Beit Jala, that's a neighborhood of Jerusalem in the Israeli mindset. And most Israelis have no idea what happens on settlements, period.
Uh-huh.
Most Israelis have not been to the West Bank and have very little idea of what happens there.
Uh-huh.
Let me move on, because I think we want to try to spend more time talking. And we're going through Hebron. You just have to imagine a tightly contained area of a city where there are 15,000 to 18,000 Palestinians and you don't see any out on a Saturday morning. This is it's hard to make out this slide. This is a balcony, a stairway coming down, and there's a Palestinian man peering over. That's as far as he there goes as we walk by. A playground given by the temporary international presence in Hebron. Those are a group essentially of observers from mostly Scandinavian countries, policemen, people who have a background in police work. And their function, this was an Oslo arrangement, is to come and observe what is happening between Israeli settlers and Palestinians. And so they will witness conflict, and they can then report to the Israeli authorities or to the Palestinian authorities, and also back to their own governments. But they cannot report to the press, to the media, what they see. Though it's no secret that they're strongly sympathetic to Palestinians. It's also probably important to mention that two TIFF observers were killed this past year just outside of Hebron as they were leaving, probably by Palestinians, though it's still a little unclear. This park was given by them, and you can see there's no one there to enjoy it.
Sniper attacks when they are on curfew?
Yeah, well, I'll mention that because we were there when one happened. So you're in this the historic area that's thousands of years old. I mean, I think these buildings are probably 500 to 800 years old here. And the settlements are essentially apartment blocks that have been bought, and then either perhaps the floor or two have been added. And of course, there's bulletproof windows and heavy security. We're walking, and this is hard to make out, so let me describe it. There are some Israeli soldiers right here and here, and they've discovered some kids that are out playing. These are Christian Peacemaker team volunteers, and we'll talk about them later on. And we're making a patrol, and they use military language, the Christian Peacemaker team. And the image that they want to lift up is that Christians have noted throughout the centuries the bravery of soldiers who are willing to lay down their lives in pursuit of their military objective. And that Christians following the way of Jesus should be no less willing to lay down our lives in pursuit of peace and justice in defense of our brothers and sisters. And so that is the sort of operative image, and that stems from a Mennonite World Conference in 1983. And the idea was that there would be tens of thousands of Christians that would be willing to lay down their lives if necessary.
Well, non-violently.
Non-violently, yeah. And that image hasn't quite caught on, or that movement hasn't quite caught on, except within a small circle, but a much wider circle than the historic peace churches such as the Quakers and the Mennonites, but includes Presbyterians and Roman Catholics and Lutherans and Methodists, and we'll come back and talk about them. So we're just turning around to try to help these kids sort of get out of the way. And I have to say the soldiers were not, they just told the kids to go home. They didn't do anything else. Okay, we're continuing our walk. There's an Israeli military vehicle. We're coming right to the end of area H1. We're about to go out to area H2, which is under Palestinian control. And you'll note an entirely different reality. It's Saturday morning. That's often a market day for Palestinians. And you begin to come out into this bustling crowd, leaving behind the watchtower, always the image of watching over the Israeli indicators of the end of H1, and the area that's under curfew is behind this woman. And we enter into a very bustling downtown area. And we're going to end the slideshow later on right here. Just keep that in mind. And I just want to point out this is a flashpoint. And I've mentioned at each meeting that we really invite you to come and visit. Come and see with your own eyes. This is a common flashpoint, and so in fact, often it's shown on the news. What happens is, I'll point out because it's unclear, is you have large cement protective barriers for the soldiers, also to prevent vehicles from entering. And you have kids that are hiding around the corner that come out and throw stones. That's why there's so much debris around. I am standing in H2, the area that we saw that bustling crowd scene. Behind here is H1, the area that's under curfew. Up here are Israeli soldiers, and then right over here there's an Israeli soldier. So what's happening is that you have kids anywhere from 8 to 14 years old. They come around, they throw a rock, and then they come back. And the soldiers, what they do, they're watching from up there, they'll shoot stun grenades, which have this incredibly loud explosion, which really startles you. If it gets really serious, they'll shoot tear gas to try to control any crowd or any conflict that's happening. And they will shoot rubber bullets as well, which can certainly kill and have killed a number of Palestinians, many Palestinians, and they will also shoot live ammunition if they believe their lives are threatened.
When I use the term rubber bullets, it's a rubber tip.
Yeah, I should have brought something. It's a round, it's about the size of a marble.
It's not a harmless.
Steel bearing surrounded by about a 1/16th of an inch rubber. And so it kills, it puts out a lot of eyes. That's another aspect of the Intifada that really angered Palestinians. Remember at the beginning they were throwing rocks and the Israelis were shooting back, and their orders were to shoot below the waist, and many, many people were shot in the head, and many eyes were taken out. Many people were blinded by the rubber bullets. But ordinary life is going on. This woman is walking across the street. I think this person is beginning to look for some cover.
What's the point of the rubber bullets? Are they just do the Israelis think that they're just going to hurt somebody? Do they actually break the skin?
Well, they do.
I mean, they
depends how far. I forget what the distance is, and it depends on the kind of bullet, rubber bullet that they're using in their weapon. But I forget if it's under 20 meters, it'll kill somebody easily. But the purpose is crowd control. So that if you're shooting at say 60 meters,
you're not killing somebody.
If you're shooting somebody below the waist, its purpose is crowd control. So here we have somebody that's coming around to throw a rock.
And how regularly do people go out there throw rocks? Is it just continue along the thing? Or?
I don't know, but this, when I said that we really invite you, so people, we would avoid these kinds of flashpoints. This is where, you know where these, this kind of theater piece. So the Israelis know what to expect, the kids know what to expect, and they do this within a kind of dramatic universal.
Yeah.
Certain
you
rules.
Do this, I do this, you do this. Before you change it, though, that up there was the to point out where the watchtower. The Israeli soldiers had taken over that upper area on the building.
Is this the slide you want?
Yes. This area.
Yeah.
Had been taken
there you
over
go. There's soldiers up here, and so this is something that happens all the time in Hebron. The reason we're talking about Hebron is for many people it encapsulates the challenges, the conflicts of the situation. Jews that feel a profound connection to the land, settlers, Palestinians that feel no less a profound connection to this city. This is, and archaeologists argue about this a lot, this is a very significant city from a perspective of biblical history. It's built in a valley, which some archaeologists claim could not then have been an Israelite city, because the Israelites would tend to build up on hillsides, and therefore the Israelites, and therefore the modern-day Israeli Jews, have no real historical claim to this land. But probably the important thing is, can law ever be based, just the question to throw out, can law ever be based on religious grounds? Or must law be based on purely secular notions that can be understood by people across cultures? This is in our home in Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives, and these are all Christian Peacemaker team people. Just to give you an idea of all the backgrounds, Anita Foss is Canadian. Anita has graduated from Divinity School. She may go to graduate school. Rich Meyer, as I mentioned, is a farmer in Indiana. Mary is from the UK, but has lived in the Boston area for the past 35 years. She's a Methodist minister.
These two on this side are Mennonite.
Yeah. And this is Lou Ann Clausen. She is Lutheran. She was a student of Fred Strickard at Wartburg College. Fred and his wife Norma are here.
The woman at the way back is a longtime peace activist, grandmother, single parent and grandmother, and is an amazing woman. I don't know what her religious background is.
And the woman in between is working with an NGO, isn't actually working with a Christian peacemaker team.
They come every Sunday to Redeemer Church, and it takes them what should be about a 45-minute trip in, because there are no Christian churches in Hebron. What should be a 45-minute trip in is sometimes 3 hours.
And this is Herod's Gate, which we would have liked to have had
started
at the beginning
with,
of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is from, in a sense, where metaphorically where the journey begins.
Back in
it doesn't really have any connection to Herod, but in Arabic, as we mentioned, the name means the tower that watches, or the gate that
the
watches.
The gates out front, is that crowd control, or is that to keep channel vehicles?
Yes, the channel vehicles. This is a really bustling area. Behind me is the major street of East Jerusalem, so I should have taken a picture looking out, because there are hundreds and hundreds of people, thousands of people close by. The Israelis have a large police station right here as well. So a couple of pictures of Herod's Gate, just to locate us. And then this is also from Herod's Gate, but this is looking up the Mount of Olives. We live up here. And this is Augusta Victoria, which is owned by the Lutheran World Federation and the Lutheran Church of the Ascension here on the Mount of Olives. And it provides wonderful guest housing. So if you come to Jerusalem, you can stay at Augusta Victoria, which was named after the Empress or Kaiserin of Prussia, who thought that ministers and religious people needed a place outside the city. This is about a Sabbath day walk outside the city to breathe in the fresh air early in the 20th century. We're back in Hebron. This now is July of last year. And we came down, a friend and I came down to help Christian Peacemaker Team. We occasionally come down to spell them, especially when their numbers are few, or if they're primarily women Christian peacemakers and they need some men. They live in two apartments, an apartment for men, an apartment for women, and they live over the chicken market in Hebron. And it smells like a chicken market. And they live very, very simply, and they live in community. And we're looking down, just as we're up on the roof, somebody way up here, this is a Muslim cemetery, beyond the cemetery, shot down at an apartment, Jewish settlement, and wounded two people standing outside, a boy and his father. It was later discovered that it was shrapnel that wounded them, so that they were probably certainly aiming for the two people out on the balcony. They weren't directly hit by the bullets, but by shrapnel from the wall. And so immediately things get very tense. What happens in the city of Hebron is, I don't think it had been quiet, in fact. It was not under curfew. Immediately, Israeli military vehicles and soldiers go through those alleyways and announce on a loudspeaker, curfew is imposed, go home, curfew is imposed. And if you don't respond immediately, you can be in serious trouble. And as soon as the shots, I think there were about a half dozen shots coming down from the hill, because I mentioned Hebron is in a valley, there are hills all around it. The Israeli soldiers, they weren't sure where the shooting came from initially, so they're firing everywhere. And they're firing with very large machine guns. And it's really frightening for everyone. And if the picture was clear, you'd see this house is just pitted with machine gun fire, as is this one. They're shooting up at where they think the shooting may have come from. And there certainly are people that are shooting down. Often they will drive in a car to some vantage point, shoot, fire off a round of ammunition, get back in the car, and they're gone in 20 seconds. But the firing from the Israeli side will continue for half an hour.
Not a great place to live.
No.
I mean, on that
wall. Particular hill, no. Yeah. not a great place.
Not exciting.
Yeah.
This woman is peering, this Muslim Palestinian is peering over the wall to sort of see what's going on. And we are up. My friend that came down with me is a journalist for a German paper. And we are up on the roof watching this. And we have an Israeli, here you have an Israeli military post. And then right next to us, in the building next to us, there's an Israeli military post that's even larger. And they're firing right over our heads. And we're up on the roof and we're watching. And it was crazy. I don't know. You know, and this is where the firing is coming from, up here, but there's a tank. This was so extraordinary a year ago. Now it's the usual. Every time we leave, we think, you know, it can't get any worse. And it gets worse all the time. And so it was very unusual to see a tank, so I took a picture of it. There's a tank up here that's firing. These are cement barriers that the Israelis erected, because beyond that is Israeli is an Israeli settlement. But the tank is firing. This is a man standing, a soldier standing on the tank. And it was so extraordinary that that was happening that we had to have a picture of it. So we're up on the roof, and this is really stupid. There's firing going on, and Christian Peacemaker team, because they are a community, we, in the morning, we talked about how stupid we were, and we realized it was really, the next morning, this was really stupid. Because, you know, and this is my friend Yorg, who's trying to get a report out of what is happening in Hebron.
The people wearing red hats and red armbands.
Yeah, those are the Christian Peacemaker team. And they are identified by the Jewish settlers and hated by the Jewish settlers. We'll talk a little bit about that. And are trusted and valued by the Palestinians. Palestinian municipality, CPT, Christian Peacemaker team, they didn't simply decide, let's go to Hebron and provide a kind of active peacemaking presence. They're always invited. So they're in about a half dozen hot spots around the world. And they're always invited by local governmental officials to take on a role that would be helpful. So we're walking up a hillside the next day. It's quiet now. Everything is under curfew. So only settlers and internationals are out. We're looking at this new construction, which is on a hillside, which is a Jewish settlement that was just some caravans, just some trailers parked up there, and the Israelis, and so illegally parked up there. And of course, trailers provide no protection whatsoever to anybody who has a gun. You can, you know, easily puncture a trailer wall. And so they, of course, then immediately demand Israeli military protection, so there's now a large military post set up here, but that isn't enough. They decide that they need permanent barrier and housing. So they immediately, even though this is on an archaeological site, even though the Israeli courts have argued that they have decided that they cannot build there, the building is going on apace. We're walking. And this is the reason, now, I don't know how clear this is the reason why we sang this song, and everyone beneath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. We're by that construction area. Up here, there's military behind us, and to our left, there are these caravans and the new construction that's going on. This is a Palestinian vineyard right here. And what happened was that the settlers decided to trash it and burn it. So the first thing they did is they came through the vineyard, they cut the vines, then they burned them, then they put barbed wire.
So you see,
they're
cut
and then burned.
And burned.
And vineyards don't grow overnight. We're, as I mentioned, really on significant land, archaeologically speaking. This is where David, it's thought, assembled his forces, and so it's very important to the Jewish settlers that they have this connection, and they are blind to anyone else's connection to this land. For 1,200 years, this has been Muslim land. As you can see by this metal doorway with the mosque, or actually the Dome of the Rock, pictured on it. This is something that happened in November, let's see, was it November or December 2000?
2001. I think it was earlier that spring.
And this is a kind of memorial and also a cry to God for revenge for the murder of this little child. She was just a baby. Her name was Shilobat Pas. And it's a cry for justice and for revenge, and it's about the terrorist. And I can't read it well enough to translate it. Here's the word terror right here. And the name of the child that died, and her last name. Here's her name and last name right here, Pas. And then there's, of course, always the Israelis. This was, a settler was out walking during curfew, so there are no Palestinians around. No, it was not under curfew. He was out walking in the market carrying his child, etc. And somebody, probably from that hillside that I pointed out, shot down. It's not known, of course, whether the person was aiming at the child or aiming at the father, but the child was hit, the father was wounded, the child was killed immediately. And immediately it went over hard for the Palestinians who had nothing, you know, the ones in the marketplace. There's a market right outside here, Palestinian market, and the settlers don't like it that they have this market. Since these pictures have been taken, there is no market. The Palestinian market has been removed. So immediately the settlers came and trashed the market place and cried vengeance. This is an area, this is a Jewish settlement back here, and there's a huge sign, I should have had it right here, in English and Hebrew, that lifts up in a kind of, well, the way that's often typified on the Palestinian side, in a way that's inciting memories. It lifts up the memory of the 1929 massacre. And it does it in much the same way that there's incitement on the Palestinian side. This is a marketplace that under the Oslo Accord is to go back to the Palestinians. Palestinians were never allowed to use it. And not only are they not allowed to use it, it has been taken over by Jewish settlers and there's construction going on now.
There are now five apartments ready to be.
And so you can see the Israeli flags right here.
Susan, you and I had a conversation at breakfast this morning. Would that marketplace be considered occupied?
Oh, certainly.
Okay. I thought so.
It was just taken.
Yeah.
And then finally, I want to lift up one person who would say there was absolutely no reason to lift her up. This is Sister Mary. She's a Catholic, Sister Ann, Ann Montgomery. She has a long history in the peace movement in the United States. She was a teacher for many, many years in the Bronx. And she was a real privilege. This is in the Christian Peacemaker team apartment in Hebron. And it's been a real privilege to have her and the other CPT members involved in the life, the ongoing life of our congregation. In fact, they are so valued that we have a church council, and with the approval of the congregation, we've designated a position on the council always for a CPT member. And because they come in and out every 3 months, the person changes.
But she's a figure like Gertrude. Who we just said goodbye to today, who is a presence of great integrity in the midst of all of this, and you have a sense that if you're with her, somehow it's all right. It's going to be all right.
And you can trust her. The story of, I think, tomorrow about Operation Baby Jesus, which took place in Bethlehem. Essentially, it was walking into a very dangerous area and walking as a small group of people, four or five of us. And she was leading us. I was nominally a spokesperson for the group because we were to encounter Israeli troops in Bethlehem. But she was the real leader, and she was the one that all of us listened to, and it was her courage that carried us along. We should have had Sister Ann's photo a little later. The scene where there were all these yellow service taxis and that bustling crowd scene. This is that corner, and this is the woman who, on a Saturday morning, also is down looking at gold jewelry. Gold is a very important element of Palestinian society. And the shop window has been completely shot up. That whole area has been shot up by the Israelis now. And she is out looking at the jewelry. And here you can see all the shooting that has gone on. The last picture. Well, maybe it is the last picture.
There should be one more. There should be the.
Yeah, it's not. I think maybe it was one of the pictures that.
Well, the picture that was missing was a picture from our congregation on a day that we were honoring Sister Ann Montgomery on the 50th anniversary of her vows as a Roman Catholic sister, just realizing, holding up, I guess, the ecumenical nature and the way that Christians together of many different backgrounds and experiences need to work together in efforts towards peace. So I think we'll open up now for we have about 10 minutes for some questions and comments.
Is this what the exterior of your church looks
yes,
like?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That
very pretty.
This square tower is the tower of the church, and the one next to it there, or actually in front of it, is the minaret of the Mosque of Omar. And this picture is taken from one of the roof areas of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or the Church of the Resurrection, which is the traditional site of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. So we're just adjacent to that very important Christian site. Comments? Questions?
Is it hard for you guys to just
live? I mean, getting groceries and things, is that an easy thing, or?
No, I mean, we have just 100 yards from where we live, there's a small grocery store and a vegetable store. They're very small. They don't carry a lot in the way of variety, but they're adequate. But we most often go out to a place called Jafar's, which is on the way to Ramallah, but very much within Jerusalem. And I wish we had brought the, we'll bring it tomorrow. We have a nicely color-printed brochure by Jafar's, by the grocery store, which is about twice the size of this room and has everything that you need. And many, many internationals shop there. And so they printed up a leaflet, because what happened as the Intifada continued, Israelis kept moving checkpoints. So Jafar's used to be on this side of the checkpoint, so there was no problem getting to Jafar's. But as the Intifada continued, more, there were several checkpoints that were put before you got to Jafar's. And so it was very, very difficult to get to Jafar's, which of course, then I mentioned that it was mostly internationals that shop there, and also Palestinians, but their business just died. It just died. And so they printed up this brochure or flyer in color that said, if you can't get to us, we'll come to you. And that was a nice
delivery now.
Yeah, delivery service, a free delivery service.
So what they do is they park their trucks on the other side of the checkpoint, and then they carry all of the things that they're gonna deliver across the area.
Is it fairly easy for internationals and the Jewish people to cross by these checkpoints?
Yeah.
Or something you just walk by and flash a badge, or
no,
do you have to wait in line?
In fact, did
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah. And no. I mean, it's yes and no. It is. It can be easy. You may be waiting for a long time in the line of people or cars, and when you come up and you flash your passport, you're just waved through. Or you may not be. You may be searched as well or asked. But most of the time, you will get through.
Yeah, and most of the time. Let me just mention one more thing about Jafar's, this grocery store. It's ironic that they will deliver to us now, because there is a grocery store on French Hill, which is next to Mount Scopus. It was the very first settlement, land taken from Palestinians and declared state land. Then tenders were put out for construction of apartment buildings, and apartments were built for Jewish Israelis. Anyway, there's a store up on the top of that hill. We occasionally go to that because it'll carry things that Jafar's doesn't have, and it's also a lot closer. Anyway, they have a delivery service too. And if you ever go, Jafar's is really friendly. I don't want to sort of stereotype falsely, but Jafar's is really service oriented. You never have to carry your own groceries to the car. You know, there's always a kid that will carry them for you. They're polite, they're friendly. It's called the co-op, that it's not a co-op in the way we might think of a co-op in, say, Minnesota or Seattle. On the food co-op up on French Hill, they're really angry people. All these Russians that work there, and they sit behind the counter and you bag your own groceries. So you can go in, and sometimes we've spent $400 on groceries. If we have a church event and we don't like to do that, but we'll sometimes have to do it. And so we're spending $400, and they'll just sit in their cash register and no one bags those groceries. And they look at you like you're taking too long bagging those groceries because the line is piling up. And it's an extremely unpleasant store, except, I mean, there are exceptions. There are kind people that will help you if you have questions or if you're buying cheese, but at the cash out, it's deadly. Anyway.
Are they much less expensive?
No, same price. You think?
More than Jafar's.
Okay.
Similar, but
they just don't have the selection.
They have a good selection.
They have a, it's like a
large church. As far as good selection.
It's okay, yeah.
Both of these stores have a good selection.
Why would you shop?
Let me just finish the story, I'll come back.
So this is a retailer, I just...
I'll explain. But they also have a delivery service, you know, where they will box everything for you in these large plastic crates and deliver it to you. But they won't deliver it to where we live, even though we're probably 3/4 of a mile from Hebrew University, which is considered sort of safe ground. But where we live, and this is long before the Intifada, is considered dangerous, and so they will not deliver there. Nor will Domino's Pizza. They won't deliver. You know, they have all these little motor scooters going everywhere. You know, you can't get them to deliver where you
live.
So we always have to, there's a big, always an advertisement in Haaretz from which this article, which I invite you, if you're interested in CPT from an Israeli perspective, you're welcome to read this article. Anyway, this Israeli newspaper in English has a big advertisement because it's published with the Herald Tribune, International Herald Tribune. Do you live in Israel? If so, you know, take advantage of the special offer for Haaretz. Well, Jerusalem, which we surely live in, is called the undivided eternal capital of the state of Israel. But you can't get anybody to deliver Haaretz to where you live. You know, we've tried for years. We say, hire Palestinians. They don't mind driving to our neighborhood. And they could get great business because all the international diplomats, all the NGO people, for the most part, live in East Jerusalem. But to come back to the retailing question, the prices are approximately the same. It varies. Sometimes it's more expensive in the from the Palestinian store. Sometimes it's more expensive from the Israeli store. Sometimes you can't get things. I'll give you a good example. The church has a Volkswagen van, okay, that was bought at a Volkswagen dealership, Johnny Rizik's Volkswagen and Audi dealership. It's in East Jerusalem. The land is worth millions. It's been offered millions of dollars for it by Israeli investors. And he won't sell because he doesn't want to sell to Israelis. But he cannot get Volkswagen to deliver parts now. He has to send a worker to East Jerusalem, to West Jerusalem, or more often to Tel Aviv, to pick up the spare parts because it's considered too dangerous now to come to East Jerusalem. What? There's a question up there.
And then back there.
Let's say I wanted to be, I wanted to immigrate to Israel and I wanted to be a settler. How difficult would it be for me? I mean, I'm Jewish, okay.
Okay.
And how difficult would it be for me to do that? How much would it cost?
Well, very easy. They would love to have you come right now. And for the same reason that we are inviting you to come and see, Israeli Jews are inviting Jews around the world to come. And that has to do with a very theological question about the diaspora. Is the diaspora a bad thing for Judaism, or is it a good thing? There's a long history of discussion about whether it's good or bad. Are you being unsupportive as a Jew not to move to the state of Israel? So, for instance, when in Austria, when Jörg Haider, Austria was where we lived prior to coming to Jerusalem, where Jörg Haider was elected this far-right politician, was elected, probably no doubt an anti-Semite. His parents were very strong Nazis. They inherited or got a great deal of land from Jews, taken essentially from Jews in Austria. And so, of course, he is persona non grata in Israel. And Israel broke off relations with Austria because of his involvement in the government. Anyway, as soon as that happened, as soon as Jörg Haider became part of the government, the next day in the Austrian papers, and I saw this myself reading the paper on the internet. There were advertisements from the Jewish agency in Austria in urging Jews to move to where it's safe for them, namely Israel. So it would be very easy. You would be making Aliyah, which means in Hebrew to go up to Jerusalem. Currently, it means to come to Israel, to move to Israel, to settle into Israeli Jewish society. You would be Olim, one who makes Aliyah. You would be a settler, and you would be invited, you would be welcome, you would be given subsidized housing.
How costly would it be?
Well, you might get a loan. Say you might get an apartment in a settlement, and it might cost $85,000, and you have to put down $35,000, and you'll have a $50,000 loan on mortgage on it. But if you stay 10 years, that mortgage might be reduced to zero. And so the settlements attract people that have ideological interests. That is, if you want to live in Hebron, those are the most zealot of the settlers. It attracts people that simply could never buy their own apartment unless they bought it in a settlement. Settlements have green grass, they have all the water you need, they have swimming pools, they can have a thriving social life, and so there are lots of reasons why people are attracted to settlements. And then there are also sort of reasons in between the really outrageous zealotry of settlers in Hebron. They're people that want to live in the biblical land of Israel.
You had a question up here?
How do you live with fear on a day-to-day basis? I mean, I know there you can give a theological answer, you know, but on a day-to-day basis with children and, you know, knowing that it's your life may be on the line, how do you do that?
Well, I think I think it takes a toll. And we have to recognize that. And so it's important that we are able to get out like this time, and the children can run around and do what they want when they want most of the time. So that's very important because they're quite constricted. And that's how you deal with it. You constrict. you don't do the things that you would otherwise do without very much thought. You don't go to the mall. You don't go to the areas of the city that you know have been attacked by suicide bombers. You weigh what you do. You always go with a cell phone so that you can, if you're delayed, which is not a bit unlikely, you can let someone know that that's what's happened to you and nothing worse, and you just
I have to say though that our lives are not sort of on the line. That shooting incident that I mentioned in Hebron, that was sort of our foolishness. We never should have been up on the roof, but it could be dangerous walking around. You try to exercise good judgment. But most of the time, this is really important to emphasize, most of the time we are perfectly safe. Much of the time we are perfectly safe, but we live in a more, as Susan mentioned, a more constricted world. So prior to the beginning of the Intifada at the end of September 2000, we drove everywhere in the West Bank, and we never had any fear whatsoever. And gradually our world has shrunk. If we go to the West Bank a lot, particularly to Bethlehem and to Hebron, and we take Palestinian taxis and essentially cross as they cross, and sometimes
I just tell a story. We live, it, the whole society lives on rumors, okay? And they just go like wildfire. So Michael is out on a run on Mount Scopus one day.
Let me just mention the context of that.
Okay.
So a friend who lives at Augusta Victoria, that hospital Lutheran compound that I mentioned, beautiful, you run right along on the Mount of Olives and Mount Scopus, and you're looking to the east, you look to the desert, to the west, you look towards Israel, towards rainfall, because it's right on the watershed line. So we're running. We're hearing mortar fire or tank shells in Bethlehem. We were hearing that as we run. That's bizarre in itself. And as we come around a corner at Mount Scopus, which is the University of Hebrew University, we notice there are about 75 soldiers in combat gear, and they're ready to move out. And we don't know why they're there, but we run by. Then we start to see Palestinian men up on the hillside looking down at their village, Isawiya. And we come over, and my friend speaks very good Arabic, and he talks to them. He discovers that their village is under curfew. So this is not the West Bank, this is Jerusalem. Their village is under curfew, and we also hear that lots of other Palestinian villages in Jerusalem, Palestinian neighborhoods, are under curfew. And we wonder what is happening. And what the Israelis are doing, they're going house to house trying to find wanted terrorists, arms caches, and so on. And so the curfew began in the afternoon. But these men, they were all men, had been out since early morning working. So they were coming back. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening. They were coming back, and they couldn't get back. Too bad. Go somewhere else for the night. And they're looking down at their village, which is about... Some of their houses are only 50 meters away, some several hundred meters. And you can see armored personnel carriers, you can see military jeeps, you can see a kind of armored bus that's used to take in prisoners. And so my friend is talking and he gets the story. And then we keep going, we keep on running. We get back to his house at Augusta Victoria. Susan, I see that Susan has been trying to reach me many times on the cell phone.
Okay, so let me tell this part now. Okay. So meanwhile, he was out on this run, I get this call from a neighbor who is the Irish representative to the Palestinian Authority.
It's like a consul general.
So she's a good friend. And she has heard from the impeccable source of Abdullah at the local grocery store that Suwanee, our neighborhood, is next. That they're going to be coming. And so she's calling everybody she knows. She's starting her network, saying, you know, okay, we got to, you know, object to this, whatever. And she says, make a sign and put it on your gate so that they know that there are internationals who live here.
When we moved in 4 years ago, there were no internationals. We were the first internationals. Since then, the Danish diplomats across the street, the Dutch diplomats, Swedish diplomats living under us, as well as the Palestinian owner of the house.
So when Michael gets back, he busily goes to the computer and makes this official-looking sign. It says, Official Church Residence, ELCA, Reverend Michael Thomas, Reverend Susan Thomas, to put on our gate. And now, this is a problem for two reasons. One is just the idea that in our neighborhood, we don't necessarily want to advertise that we're separate from the neighborhood and that we should somehow have separate treatment. And in a way, you know, it's like, look, if they're going into Palestinian homes and searching and whatever, you know, they should be doing the same for internationals, kind of that kind of mentality. It also
except for diplomats, there's a different issue involved in terms of diplomatic.
But we're a church, okay, so that's different. But and then it also felt a little bit like you know, the angel of death at Passover, you know, you go and mark your gate. It's like theologically, you're just sort of like, nah.
And so the question was, do we help our Palestinian downstairs neighbor with that sign, or do we hurt him? And we rely on him a great deal. He's a Palestinian Muslim. He is always talking about peace and the life of prayer. He and his wife and their son, wonderful, wonderful friends. And the first time that we sort of encountered his concern for us was when we had just moved there. We hadn't been there for about a month. And we were invited to the Danish Lutheran pastor's home for dinner. And this was in 1998. And we saw that they had some videos. We said, could we borrow this video, Exodus? How many have seen Exodus? You know, Paul Newman and all, you know, heroic music and all that. So we started watching, but then it's too late. And we come home with our kids. And for the first time, we saw Israeli troops in our neighborhood. We don't know why they were there. There was a bomb, there was a burned out car. There were rocks all over, so somebody had been throwing rocks and burned a car. And we don't know what was going on. But we get in, and our neighbor, a Palestinian neighbor, greets us and sort of gives us the background of what had been going on. And we go upstairs, and I just say to him offhandedly, honey, I think I'm going to go up to the roof and just see what is going on. And he just blanches.
His eyes. Like this.
But because sometimes Palestinians never want to tell you directly what they're thinking, he put it in the subjunctive in English. I would not advise that action.
That was very polite.
Because people have been shot on roofs by thinking, soldiers thinking that they mean them harm. And so we didn't. So then we go upstairs. There's still the soldiers searching around, powerful lights and so on. And our two older children are so intrigued with the movie, they stay up watching it late into the night. And that's the kind of reality that we live in. We live in this reality that of Exodus on one hand and Israelis and the joy of coming home for Jews after the Holocaust, the joy of coming back to the land, which was a joy for them, but became a catastrophe for the Palestinians. That there was a people in the land. Golda Meir, the first prime minister of Israel, said that we are a people without a land, and this is a land without a people. You know, it's a marriage made in heaven. And of course, though the land had a people, and it was a catastrophe for them. And so we're watching Exodus on TV, and Israeli soldiers are searching around the houses. And that's our life. But you are invited to come and see with your own eyes.
We're at the end of our time and beyond it, so.
Who owns the properties?
Where we live?
Who holds title to the property?
Palestinian. Where we live is owned by Palestinians.
This is important,
Brothers. And I'll be glad to talk with you right now if you want about that, because it's a very interesting property title, very complex and very important.
But the simple answer is that this land was held by Jordan. Mm-hmm.